What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends with Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, a lot of people have been talking about people who work for a living. They work with their hands. They work in very low-wage jobs here in America. And how are they going to survive going forward, given all the changes in our society?
Well, I think we need a lot of retraining because I guess there'll be jobs, but they're going to be different jobs with IT, you know, flagging down people-less cars, whatever else.
Well, let's be honest. A lot of the changes that we've already experienced in our culture, in our economy, have had a great impact on the white working class. And that's why a lot of them have really been quite rebellious in this period. We start with the Tea Party, lots of people saying, hey, what happened during the financial crisis? And then, of course, many looking at what was going on in Europe and the whole Brexit movement. And they said, well, we need our own action here in America. So let's bring on Donald Trump and let's take his message and see if he can help us. Because they've been really out there in the wilderness for a while, John, thinking that their wages are shrinking. A lot of their kids are on opioids. I mean, it's a difficult time for many in the white working class.
Well, the unfortunate part is even if we win this war with China that Donald Trump is fighting, the jobs aren't the same as they were in the past. I mean, we're not going to need three shifts working 7 days a week to produce products anymore. So we got a really big problem to face here in this country and around the world, any manufacturing, you know, country.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think we have to understand, look, we don't need a big cheating scandal in our colleges to remind us that the upper middle class and the upper class have all kinds of advantages, whether they're earned or whether they're not earned. They can endow a chair and have a child who gets in under a legacy provision. There are lots of advantages that people who have money have, and they really are somewhat clueless as it relates to what's going on with the everyday lives of the working class in America. And again, there are some in the white working class who think that perhaps during a period of affirmative action that somebody else is getting something from the government that they're not getting. And they're a little bit resentful of that. But I don't think we have figured out how do we make people feel that America is fair and just and working for them.
Yeah, you know, this is how ultimately we got Donald Trump, and he's kind of failed us in that aspect of bringing people together and bringing jobs back to this country. And really, we're not even realizing what the jobs are going to look like. So we need some really deep thunk on this one.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why we're bringing to you today on the podcast America Trends, Joan Williams. And she's got some astonishing things, John, that she's going to show us and tell us. For example, when you think about the white working class, she's saying that in a sense, that's what the white middle class really is, that they're really not as advantaged as we might think, that the white middle class is feeling all kinds of pressure today. And we know the medical bills are skyrocketing just to be connected to all the necessary technology. Look at a car today, $40,000, $50,000. You look at all the debt that is piling up because of colleges and credit cards. I mean, they are beleaguered today in America. And she's saying that those who are in the professional class just really don't understand the plight of everyday people in America.
Well, I think she's right. I mean, you look at the way businesses are run out there now. I think they've forgotten what service is and how to treat people. I think it's really bad most of the places I go to.
Well, look at the tax law that was passed, John, that was meant for the middle class. And then I remember the president about 6 months later, hey, I'm going to give a 10% cut to the middle class. I thought that's what you said you did already. What has happened? All kinds of stock buybacks. The rich are getting richer. I mean, come on. It just continues time and time again. Well, let's get to Joan Williams, John. The book is called White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. It's today on America Trends. With us on the line on America Trends is Joan Williams, and she is an author and a professor, and she has written a book called White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. So how clueless are we? Because America has, you know, thought of itself less in class terms often than in many of our European counterparts.
We're pretty darn clueless. We tend to think there is no class in America, and alas, that's not true. There is. There are very sharp and defined class distinctions that have begun to play a really central role in American politics.
And how are these classes beginning to interact or react to each other? In other words, I think the vast preponderance of Americans, and I know that in your work you try to make certain that we don't all fall into this trap where we all feel, well, I'm in the middle class, and maybe not everybody is in the middle class. So for your book itself, White Working Class, what were you trying to say as opposed to white middle class?
I actually didn't even want to use the term working class. I think it's very confusing. But the point is that the class conflict that is driving American politics today is between the professional managerial elite, roughly the top 17% of Americans, and the middle class, roughly the middle 53%. That elite has a median income of around $175,000. The middle class, often called the working class, has a median annual income of about $75,000. But the conflict between those two groups is really what's driving American politics.
The professional managerial elite. Who is a member of that? Explain what you're really talking about here, because you're not talking about the ultra rich, because I think many in the working class, according to your work, they really aspire to at least look upon those people as people who might be able to provide them with jobs. So they're not as much in conflict as they are with this professional managerial elite. Why is that? Because they're closer as it relates to income levels than, of course, the ultra-rich.
Yeah, well, the professional managerial elite includes the top 1%, but it also includes 16% of Americans below them. The easiest way to define who is in that elite is who is a college grad. Income matters, too, but graduating from college is crucially important because it determines your life prospects, whether you choose to take a lower income job like a teacher or you choose to take a highly paid job like in tech or investment. If you have a college education, typically you're culturally quite different from people who don't have a college degree.
So it's not as much about money as it is about worldview or the way
that... Money is important, but if you had to choose one thing, it's graduating from college.
So if you're on that path, as opposed to the high school track or less, how do you then find that we are distinguishing one from the other, or how do we... let's say I'm in that more professional managerial elite. How do we define ourselves in relation to the white working class?
Who is, by the way, as we've said, the actual the people in the middle. The people who are in the professional managerial elite, first of all, tend to have different social networks than non-elites. Many people who go to college have gone away to college, and so have had national or international, really transnational networks from the time they were in their late teens and tend to be very proud of being global citizens. People who don't graduate from college or get a very modest college education close to home and stick around where they grew up tend to have very local networks of family and friends they've known forever. And they tend to be reliant on those networks for things that many more affluent people buy, like child care and elder care and help fixing the roof, for example. This is one of the reasons that the so-called white working class, and it's really true of non-elites of all races, they tend to stay close to home, mm-hmm. and that's very unlike many professionals who feel very comfortable and indeed that it's necessary for them to move to take a better job. And that means that when factories have closed down, I mean, Waterbury, Connecticut used to be the brass capital of the world. And so when factories close down, Americans are now much less likely to move than they used to be. Part of that's just the two-income family. In order to make it worthwhile to move, you need not one better job, you need two better jobs. And you need them to be so much better that the fact that you're now going to have to pay for child care because you're moving far from grandma, that you need to come out ahead even with all that. And so one of the things that's happened in the United States in recent times is that you have the economic opportunity really being concentrated on a few areas of the country, metropolitan areas.
So the Austins, the Bostons, the New York, San Francisco.
We're doing good here.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, we're doing really good. But in many of the other areas of the country that used to have really thriving economies, and Waterbury is a good example, but what's being called the heartland in the middle of the country is another good example. They really feel they've been forgotten and left behind. And in large part, they're right, and they're very upset about it. And so, you know, it's no news. One of the key things driving economic populism is economics.
Oh, absolutely. So let's go back and look at this. Then the professional managerial elite, when they're trying to understand and relate to why, let's say, this white working class might be voting for a certain person or another, and they say, well, you know, why are they voting that way? Because that may not be in their interest. Or why don't they just move? Why don't they pick up if they don't have a job in Wisconsin and, you know, leave, or Waterbury, Connecticut, or what have you? And yet those who are in this other group that we're talking about, the white working class, they may prioritize stability, and they like where they are. They've got those connections. They have connections to religion and to other things that somebody who's more cosmopolitan and who's moved around the country just doesn't have that relation to.
People from working class families value community more highly than people in the professional managerial elite, who tend to be more focused on individual achievement. And so that's another reason why people are reluctant to move. But it's very common to say, you know, these people are idiots, they voted against their own self-interest. But I think it's important to recognize that for many of these areas that feel left behind, they feel that Democrats have done as little for them as Republicans have. And often with considerable justification, because what we have seen in the past 40 years is the wages, particularly of working class men, fall very sharply, mm-hmm. and the fate of working class communities really constrict very sharply. And so you have these huge areas of the country where you have very few good jobs and a lot of what are being called a growing despair, leading even to the despair deaths of suicide and the opioid epidemic. And so when that's what's going on in your community, people have gotten very, very angry. And that is the anger that's driving economic populism. Now, one of the mysteries in this context is that this is actually true of people of color and whites as well. Blue-collar guys and blue-collar families tend to resent professionals but admire the very rich. And the reason they resent professionals is because those are the people who order them around every day. Some college kid who doesn't know a hoot about my job but is perfectly willing to tell me how to do it, said one. Didn't use the word hoot, but and many working class whites also see government bureaucrats as just another smart ass college kid who's telling them how to live their lives, and they're not amused. Particularly since, as you point out, they often have different values than the college grads have. So they don't want to turn in to professionals. To them, they often see professionals as kind of shirt and tie types who spend their whole life sucking up to each other. They want to do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay is more of the self-image. What their sort of fantasy is to be truly wealthy and own their own businesses. This is the allure of the order taker, wanting to be an order giver. To say, for example, you're fired. And so it made perfect sense to me that they were bonded with somebody like Donald Trump and yet resented deeply somebody like Hillary Clinton. It comes across as often almost as professorial.
Now, you're a professor, and I think you're rather liberal, I think, from...
Oh, I'm totally. Okay. I'm totally so liberal.
Okay, now liberal
nothing
elites...
Nothing complicated about that.
Okay, so liberal elites, you say, don't have a clue about the white working class. So you've explained to us who they are, the white working class, and what they look at the world and their worldview. What is the worldview about the liberal elites? Have they leapfrogged over the white working class to show that they have great empathy and concern for those who are truly disadvantaged in our society, those who've been marginalized and left in the cold, with racial disparities and other income inequalities? Explain. I mean, do they feel that, well, you're not worthy of my time, but another group is?
What sociologists call emotion rules. We have rules about how we're supposed to feel. And we all know in the U.S. that we're supposed to feel kind of bad about race. That might be because we had slavery. A legitimate reason to feel bad, by the way.
Yes.
We should definitely be addressing race. Often the emotion rules of the progressive elite are that we should feel badly about race, we should feel really concerned about LGBTQ and trans individuals, we should feel infinite empathy and compassion towards immigrants, but when it comes to blue-collar whites, there's nothing but disdain. That is actually a really good way to hurt all the other groups, if that's your goal, to have an elite saying, we're going to care about groups A, B, and C, but heap scorn on group D. What's going to be the attitude of group D towards A, B, and C? That's pretty predictable.
Well, you write that when various programs have a certain eligibility requirement, such programs are limited to those below a certain income level and exclude those just a notch above. This is a recipe for class conflict. Seems like we've got that going here, going in all kinds of directions.
You have to say it hasn't been easy for politicians in the United States because we're basically among advanced industrialized democracies. We have a truly unusual and stingy welfare state. And so it's been really hard to get those kinds of programs passed. And the instinct has been, well, since it's so hard to get them passed, let's just provide a decent life for the least fortunate. So there was a logic there, but the problem, what we have seen now, is that if you provide, just focus the money on the least fortunate, then people who are hardworking families, just a little bit richer, end up getting nothing and asking themselves, you know, why do I have to work so hard and pay my taxes to somebody else who is not in the same situation as me? And that's just politically a no-go, and has made the fact that we lack very basic things like universally accessible health care and parental leave much, much worse.
So when we see a tax cut that goes primarily to corporate bigwigs, how does that affect those in the white working class? Do they say, well, that's okay because that will give them the opportunity to perhaps build more work and more jobs, and I can perhaps benefit from that? Because one of the things you say about the white working class is they like to work.
Yes, they respect work. Well, I mean, you know, as a Democrat, I found Trump's tax cut deeply shocking. It gave a few hundred dollars to many middle-class families and gave often literally millions to the wealthiest Americans on the assumption that they would go out and create jobs. Well, of course, what a lot of them did is they just paid dividends to their shareholders, and as one of their shareholders, it was awesome. But as an American, that was pretty disturbing, particularly since the result, I mean, the explicit strategy, and Republicans like Paul Ryan were very open about this, was to drive the deficit up so high that it would become inevitable to cut programs like Medicare and Social Security. To me, that is really a step in the wrong direction. It would be the elderly used to be the poorest group of Americans before Social Security, and if we go in the direction of eliminating those two programs, that would very soon happen again. So I do think that the tax cut was a very, I think it was shocking.
But The question about your book, I mean, your message, it seems, for professionals and managerial types is pretty clear, that as much as they may look at those who have reasons to be in poverty and perhaps find reasons that they want to give comfort and aid to individuals who are in real distress, you suggest, of course, that there are structural factors behind the issues that the working class are dealing with, and they need to be understood as well.
I think that we do need a more robust social safety net in the United States, but it needs to be in the form of universal benefits so that everybody benefits and everybody has an interest in supporting the programs, and you don't have this weird effect where people just one notch above get nothing, and that fuels resentments. But the main point, and this is something Democrats sometimes forget, is not about government benefits. It's about jobs. Most people want a decent job that provides, that can support a family in a kind of modest middle-class standard of living. That's certainly what working class people want and have always wanted. And for a few decades after World War II, people in blue-collar jobs could support a family with a basic middle-class standard of living, and now that's gone with the wind. And when people lose good jobs, often they get very poor quality kind of muck jobs, whether they're working at McDonald's or whether they're working in another kind of job that where they you hardly it's a part-time job, you don't really get enough hours to live. Often your schedule changes every single week. The wages are very low. And this has those kinds of jobs just simply do not meet the expectations of Americans for that if you work hard, that hard work should pay.
Well, it was Bill Clinton who said, you know, if you play by the rules, I mean, you should be able to, you know, advance in our society. So that obviously is a problem. But I've got to ask, I mean, are we talking past each other where now it's really impossible if I've got a certain world view and I look at many social and cultural issues? I know the book earlier that has been referenced, What's the Matter with Kansas? And this goes back several years, Thomas Frank. And, you know, well, why aren't you voting your interests in terms of unions? There's a certain resentment among the white working class about unions, even though unions were the best friend of the working person in America for so many years. So are we, though, at such a point where we're just really in different places altogether, and we're just not looking to communicate with each other in a way that can bridge some of the divides that really seem to be as much cultural as economic?
I hope not, and I don't think so. I think that people need to give other Americans the benefit of the doubt and assume that they're basically sensible people who are describing the world as they see it. Now, we live in a society where class plays a really important role, which means that people of different classes see the world differently. But they need to really listen to each other, and I think there's really just a few simple points that people need to recognize. Number one, hard work should pay off. Americans feel entitled to that, and they should feel entitled to that in one of the richest countries in the world, and we have gotten seriously off track there. Number two, everybody deserves respect, and you deserve respect whether you're a plumber or whether you're a tech entrepreneur. Now, tech entrepreneurs are great, but when I get up in the morning and turn on the faucet, it's not because of some knowledge worker that water comes out. It's because of the people who work at the water treatment plant and because of plumbers. And those are also important jobs. The third main thing that people need to realize is that if you have gone to college and have a national or transnational national network and have a lot of human capital so that you know you'll always be able to get a job, you're going to be far more open to risk, bohemian values, artisanal food, artisanal spiritualities, which after all just show how smart and thoughtful you are. Those are just tastes. Those are tastes that are part of a class-based disposition. So that if you are someone who has grown up in the town where you were born and have a very small and dependable group of family and friends and put more of your identity into being a good family member and a good community member rather than being the absolutely most successful person in the world at work, you're going to tend to have more traditional values. You're going to focus your spirituality on the religion you grew up with rather than something you made up yesterday. And you are going to have a really high respect for traditional roles in the family rather than wanting to smash gender wherever you see it. One of these worldviews is not enlightened and the other dark ignorance. They're just tastes. They're different dispositions. They're different tastes. And we need to look across those different dispositions and different tastes and kind of live and let live.
What's happening in relation to the fact that there are a lot of people predisposed to think that they, because of their college education today, growing up in these very uncertain times and a changing relationship between employers and employees, that they should be part of that professional managerial elite, but they actually are living a life of the working white class, so that they really aren't there, but in their minds
These are the Bernie voters.
Right.
I mean, those are the people who voted for Bernie. And I think, you know, the dark side is that there are a lot of Americans who are facing just far too much economic uncertainty. The bright side is that there are a lot of Americans who are facing a lot of economic uncertainty, and they're very angry about it. And this definitely includes people in the heartland and the white working class, but it also includes working class people of color, and it includes, as you point out, a lot of millennial and younger voters.
Yes.
Who got that college degree and shouldered that very heavy debt and still find themselves working in jobs that only require a high school education or require less training than they have. So they're paying back college loans on the salary of a high school grad. And they're hurting too. I mean, the bad news is that economic inequality has gotten so bad that it's even affecting the elite. That's the bad news economically and morally, but it's good news politically, because the politician who finds a way to tap into that sense of economic bereavement that is so broad and widely spread in the United States could be a real force for the good.
Very interesting way to wrap that up. White working class overcoming class cluelessness in America. Joan Williams, thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thanks for your interest. I really appreciate the thoughtful conversation.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.